Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Professor Peter Skerry with us. He is a professor of political science at Boston College. He's had a long career. Before that, he was a fellow in at the Brookings Institution, and he was at American Enterprise Institute in previous decades. He ran an important research center in Washington, D.C. for UCLA for several years. His books include... from 1993, a book called Mexican Americans, The Ambivalent Minority. More recently, he has a book called Counting on the Census, Race, Group Identity, and the Evasion of Politics. So he's been at the center of issues that are now, probably more than ever before, at the focus of political life in America. Thank you, Professor Skerry.
Thank you, Mark, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, what prompts... this specific conversation is two articles that you've had in the American Interest recently. They are both on populism, but they try to dig deeper, not just historically, but also, I don't know if you'd put it psychopolitically, into the nature of populism. And why don't we just start with a few definitions. One of the things you open with in your first article is noting that there is a left-wing populism and a right-wing populism. As well, we can observe that historically. Where would you draw the significant differences beyond simply the political aims of right-wing populism and left-wing populism?
It's a little hard to disentangle the political aims when we're talking about populism, it seems to me. But
right.
But broadly speaking, I would say, certainly in the current era, left-wing populism is focused on economic concerns, while right-wing populism or conservative populism may have economic concerns or preoccupations, but I think much more importantly, conservative populism is driven by cultural concerns about what's going on in the broader society and the broader state of American arts and letters and popular culture.
Do you think that one reason for that might be that the left feels that the culture has drifted more in their direction than in a conservative direction? They don't need to worry about the culture so much.
Well, I don't think the left or people on the left would accept that as you stated it, but I'm inclined to agree with the way you put it. I think people on the left don't appreciate or don't acknowledge their hegemony. Their cultural hegemony. But I think it is a fact that the left dominates the media, the popular culture, the foundations, universities,
the art world,
and so forth. But they don't acknowledge that, I don't think. And I think their dominance definitely drives much of the cultural populism among conservatives.
Let's pause for a minute. That's a curious denial, or maybe that's too strong a word, denial. But I have heard, actually, leftists and the stronger liberals say that they don't know what I'm talking about when I talk about the drift of the universities in some cases, a pretty hard left direction. Or when I talk about the dominance of liberal outlooks in mass media, in Hollywood, in the digital world with Silicon Valley now. Silicon Valley might have been some kind of Wild West libertarian universe back in 1995, but that isn't the case today. What is the nature of that disavowal?
Well, you may be shooting a bit above my pay grade here, but let me take a stab at that. I think part of their disavowal reflects preoccupations among liberals and people on the left with with some real problems in American society, increasing income inequality, continuing problems and real troubling issues among African Americans, which I don't think, you know, are by any means resolved in America. I think people on the left and their liberal allies focus on those kinds of continuing problems and allow that their focus on those to convince themselves that they don't have as much influence and authority in the wider society as they do.
And I imagine, Peter, that they could point to 2016 as absolute proof of their position.
Well, I think they could, and they do, for sure. Albeit, I would sketch out a different explanation for 2016, which I do in these two pieces, which of course is, I think, what happened in 2016, very much is a response, partly to economic dynamics, the increasing economic inequality that I talked about, but also very, very much a response to the cultural and social hegemony of liberals and leftists in American society. That they don't seem to, like we just said, that they don't seem to quite grasp themselves.
In your essay, the first one, you also coin a different term. This could be, I think you coined this term, that is procedural populism. Is that your term, or did you take that from someone else? And what is it?
No, I think for better or worse, it's my term.
Okay.
And what I'm trying to address when I coined that phrase is this. First of all, I think it's important to point out that these days, populism is not a label that people on the left or liberals readily or enthusiastically embrace. There's a lot of fancy footwork around these different terms, progressive, populist, a lot of confusing language. But bottom line, people on the left and liberals don't cotton to populism these days as a term. They tend to want to impute that to conservatives. Nevertheless, they have a long history of embracing populism, and one aspect of that populism that I talk about and when I focus on procedural populism derives strongly from the 1960s and notions of participatory democracy. I'm not saying that procedural populism necessarily traces back to 19th century populism, but today, for sure, I would say procedural populism is reflected in this seemingly unquenchable thirst and desire to promote greater democracy, small d democracy, throughout our politics. Resulting in demands to eliminate the Electoral College, to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate, and generally speaking, to make it easier and easier for more and more people to participate in politics. That's what I mean by procedural populism, that the people must decide, if you will.
Right. And I remember reading that term participatory democracy, and I think it's in the Port Huron statement. I think it appears there. And the idea there being to reduce as many of the representational mediations between a citizen and a policy or an enactment of the law in some way. And you actually, in your second essay, this jumps ahead a little bit, you actually find that this idea of participatory democracy or the procedural populism is a genuine threat to what you call representative democracy, correct?
Yes. You're absolutely right that participatory democracy does come out of the new left in the early 1960s in the Port Huron Statement, but it has a persistent impact on our politics and the way we think about politics. Yeah, I argue in both parts of both of these pieces, part one and part two, that this is really an undermining of our political institutions that we've been witnessing and that we continue to see advocated, and that we're experiencing the downsides of, that we have a political system in place now where we pushed notions of participation and opening up political processes to such a degree that we don't have any real authoritative structures in place that will help us sort out the choices and the priorities that we must address. That we've kind of created through this notion of participatory democracy a kind of free-for-all where our institutions are so weakened and where authority and hierarchies are so weakened that we don't have a way of ordering our preferences and choices and making much sense of the way ahead.
And one of the casualties that you mention of that process is the political party, the machinery of the political party, the people who make decisions for the party, that they have been in some ways overlooked or bypassed or even routed by the participatory impulse. Yes?
Very much so. This is an important slice of our not so distant history, growing out of the upheavals of the late 1960s and into the 1970s, that I'm not sure many of us are terribly mindful of these days. But in the spirit of fostering greater democracy and greater participation within the parties, and this started off most vehemently, if you will, most full-throatedly, among the Democrats, but it has definitely affected the Republican Party as well. That we've opened things up to the degree again, there isn't much room for the discretion of leaders, of people who spend their working hours thinking about and doing politics. We've opened it up to people who have concerns with single issues, with issues of the moment, but we really haven't left much room for structures and authority within the party, so that the people who wind up who wound up being in charge aren't there anymore. We've got a system where it's so wide open and so non-hierarchical that it's hard to pinpoint who's calling the shots, which of course isn't to say that someone isn't calling the shots. As soon as I say this, I'm mindful that somebody listening to this podcast will say, well, what's he talking about? Mm-hmm. Obviously, big money interests are involved and they're calling the shots. Campaign finance is a big issue. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't deny that money is playing an important role in contemporary politics, but that doesn't mean that the money is organized in any coherent way. Different moneyed interests will weigh in on different issues and the different parties. But again, there's no overall coherence of the sort that our political party leaders used to have.
Yeah, in the old days, would you see the Tea Party as part of this rise of, well, maybe another word is grassroots, but participatory democracy taking place outside the established channels, and that in the old days there was no way a Tea Party type candidate would be able to take out an established figure like Senator Bennett in Utah. who lost, I think he was it 2010 or 2012. Mm. The idea of him losing, or that AOC would come up and take out one of the established members of the Democratic House. What are these manifestations of the breakdown of that political hierarchy?
Exactly. But of course, those examples, and there are lots of others, to be fair, highlight the origins of this kind of political ethos now, if you will, which is to say, in the 1960s, in the midst of the social and political turmoil of that era, including the civil rights movement, but probably especially the Vietnam War, whatever one thinks about those substantive issues, it is fair to say that the then existing party structures, where you did have party leaders and party insiders who controlled the decision-making within the party, weren't very responsive to what was going on in the wider society.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's only fair to acknowledge that. But we've now gone to the other extreme, where the extent to which within the parties there is no real source of authority. It's a kind of wide open tabula rasa for the most enthusiastic, most energetic forces of the day to prevail, which doesn't necessarily mean it's a majority. It just means it's the folks who have the most energy and the most, who are the most riled up, they can prevail.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no counter pressure from any established organization to counter them.
Let me give you a quote from the second article. You say, "The media now effectively wield the power once held by party insiders."
Right. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that was the next thought I was going to turn to, which I keep saying, no one seems to be in charge. In a strict sense, no one is in charge. I think that's the problem. Except into this vacuum, into this lack of a formal hierarchy, the media have moved in a very important and fundamental way. The media now plays a role, and I'm not just talking about the media on the left. I'm not talking just mm-hmm. about MSNBC. I'm talking about the media generally, including Fox News. I'm talking about all media.
YouTube? Would you put the digital media as well? YouTube, Twitter?
Yes.
They're giving access to people, but... Well, actually, that's another. This is a more complicated question that maybe we shouldn't go into. Of what is the standing of a platform like YouTube or Twitter? But let's get back to your train of thought that.
Well, I think the question you pose is a good one, and I think we need to do a lot more thinking about how the internet and such media platforms provided there. Are an extension of what we've seen in the mass media up to now, and or something different. But I think my more general point is that the media have moved into this authority vacuum that we mm-hmm. created in our political system, and are effectively calling the critical shots. And I think the best example of that is what we've seen in 2016 among Republicans in the primaries, and this year leading up to 2020 on the Democratic side. Debates that we've seen of the, 12, 15, 16, 20 candidates. Why do we have so many candidates up there? It's because nobody within the party has the ability to winnow down those aspiring to run. But who controls the forum? Who decides who's up on the stage?
Mm-hmm.
Who decides the nature of the questions, the format, the whole tenor of the event? Well, these are all decisions that are substantially, if not completely, decided by the media, by the individual networks. And that's an enormous change in our politics. And I think it's one that's largely not acknowledged.
And I would say populists on both sides feel that increasing authority of the media, and that's why the attack on the media by Trump has been, I think, so far at least, I think it's been a great success. I actually wonder why more of the Democrats don't develop a more adversarial relationship to the media. But certainly, you say at one point that the media, perhaps drunk with their own power, you accuse them of, quote, myopic self-importance and arrogance. And I think so many people, just ordinary men and women of the street, feel that very strongly out of the media, and that their increasing power has come at a cost to their own credibility.
I think so. I mean, I think, as I argue in the pieces, again, there's some, you know, to be fair to the media, there's some legitimacy to their sense of importance. Mm-hmm. In the latter half or latter third of the 20th century, they played an important role in the civil rights movement. They played an important role in reporting on the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. When the government wasn't always to be trusted.
See Peter, we remember the extraordinary authority that Walter Cronkite had, but it was an authority you wouldn't call him, at least his appearance on camera was quite different in terms of self-importance and arrogance there. But he had tremendous reach, yeah?
Well, he had obviously had tremendous reach, but he also played a very different hand. He didn't weigh in any way the way media or you know, journalists do today, whether on we're talking about the left or the right. I mean obvious to you and me, but maybe not to all our listeners, figures like Walter Cronkite brought the news to the American people, but without any valence, without any strong perspective or opinion. There were opinion journalists on the air, people like mm-hmm. Eric Severide, a name that many of our listeners may not be familiar with, who, you know, very, very notably had, you know, small segments where they were clearly editorializing, mm-hmm. But nothing like the pervasive opinionating and editorializing that we see on the left and the right today in the media. It's obviously a very, very different kind of environment.
Now, another area that you talk about as developing an adversarial relationship, at least to the politicians on the right, is the universities. And you wonder why Trump hasn't attacked the universities more. And when I read that you talk about this, I said, you know something, you're right. I mean, the conservatives are talking about the universities all the time. Trump really doesn't spend much attention on what's happening on campus. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because he has I think he has bigger fish to fry.
Yeah.
I think the media, like we've talked about, is obviously a big area of focus for him, and it's also true that I think that his more proximate target, for better or worse, are various minorities or minority spokesmen. Immigrants have obviously figured into his perspective and are among his targets, and those targets of minorities, of immigrants that Trump has gone after, I think are typically championed by people in the universities and the elements in the universities that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. But Trump, I think, for better or worse, shrewdly, I think, has focused on the weaker elements in this kind of triangulation, if you will. We've got Trump. We've got the universities and the elites and the experts that come out of the universities, but the forces and the people that those educated elites from universities champion are the various minorities and immigrants that Trump has chosen to focus on, because I think they're the weaker element. Mm-hmm. in that constellation. So I think the university elites and the forces they represent are in the background because Trump is taking an easier shot at minorities. I think that's how I would describe it.
Now, in this vacuum that you talk about, that the media have stepped into, you also mention a couple of other figures entities that have stepped into the vacuum. One is called checkbook organizations, and the other is the quote policy entrepreneur. The second one first. What is a policy entrepreneur?
Yeah, well, a policy entrepreneur is a term that political scientists use that I think gets at something that isn't always recognized, which is that today, especially in recent decades, there are a lot of issues that come up. They tend to have come up on the liberal left side of things, but there are certainly policy entrepreneurs on the right as well that require a lot of ground clearing, a lot of throat clearing, a lot of work upfront that requires investment of time, energy, resources that don't obviously and necessarily pay off. You've got to build an organization. You've got to establish a donor list. You've got to lay the groundwork in order to put together the kind of effort that people need to put together to get the kind of attention, whether it's media or otherwise, to get your particular issue on the public agenda. So that's what that really is describing is a set of activities and skills that aren't so dissimilar from what a business entrepreneur has to undertake. Mm-hmm. You're making an investment on the basis of a bet of future returns, if you will, and that's what a policy entrepreneur is. And what that speaks to is the second part of your question, is that in recent decades, more and more of our politics is focused on issues that are not easily organized around, issues having to do with various kinds of concerns, whether it's the environment, whether it's
LGBT
choice on
rights,
one side,
or, yeah,
combating and trying to limit abortion on the other. Mm-hmm. These kinds of broad public issues that affect large numbers of people, but don't necessarily have well or obvious interest immediately behind them. These kinds of broad stroke issues that affect large numbers of people don't necessarily get much attention until some policy entrepreneur manages to put together an organization where he or she can reach large numbers of people, not to participate necessarily, not to come to meetings, but to contribute money in the most obvious instance, so that they can maintain an organization in Washington or the state capitol, mm-hmm, where they can amass the appropriate personnel that are needed to investigate issues, to conduct media campaigns and get the attention of the media and bring political pressure to bear to political actors. So those two concepts, a checkbook or book organization, which relies on people contributing their money, not so much their time or their direct participation, if you will, is part of this dynamic that reflects these two processes playing off of one another.
Right. Last question, Peter. Who do you think is going to win the Democratic nomination?
I'm not a great prognosticator. I think that's a real hard one to handicap.
Politics are so. I mean, a year is an eternity in politics. I remember one political scientist at Emory back in 1992. I think in January of 1992, he gives a little speech saying, "It is absolutely impossible for George H.W. Bush to lose this coming November." His approval rating after the Gulf War was something about 85%. It was astronomical. And people were saying, Bush, there's no way that anyone can beat him. Well, you know, 9 months later, it happened. So, yeah, that was a wise demur.
But your own kind of response, I think, points to an even more important point, which relates back to what we've been talking about, which is that we have a political system in place now that, because there are greatly weakened, if almost non-existent, hierarchies, where sources of political judgment and wisdom have been so marginalized, if not eliminated. And we've got a political system whereby there are so many individual actors. It's almost like we're talking about crowd behavior, where we have possibilities for large numbers of individuals to get involved in politics, but that then creates a system where there's enormous volatility. And that isn't to say that there aren't sources of authority, whether it be, like we talked about, in the media, varied money interests who will try to impose some sort of order on this kind of on this very volatile kind of agglomeration of political actors that we have. But predicting where that's going to go at this point in the game, particularly, is really hard to do. Because there's no overarching order or mechanism that would help us figure that out at this point.
Peter Skerry, the essay that we've taken a lot of this from is entitled "The Dead End of Quote More Democracy." It's in the American Interest. Thank you, Professor Skerry.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed talking to you.